This is the Everyday Business Show.
I'm going to do it to the best of my ability, because if I fail, that means I fail for my entire female nation, I call it.
Is that possible? That was the question for myself. And it is absolutely possible.
Good afternoon, Australia. Good evening, America. And welcome to everyone listening across the planet. I'm your host, Tony Lontis, and this is the Everyday Business Show, where we talk about life, business, and the universe. And that's precisely what we're going to do today. And in a moment, I'm going to introduce you to an amazing young man. But before I do that, just a reminder, if you're listening on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, or Twitter, my beautiful VAs, Hannah and Renee, are listening and waiting for your comments and questions and to send you any links for things that we talk about today. And a big reminder too that we would love you to subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find us under Tony Lontis on YouTube if you just search in the YouTube search bar. We're also visible on BBS Radio, and thank you so much to my amazing hosts, BBS Radio TV out of Houston, Texas, USA, and the gorgeous TJ, who is the comforting voice I hear every week and every show before we go live to air, calms my nerves and preps me for the show. Now, a reminder that the replays of these shows, the videos, are available on Binge Networks USA and Tony TV across all LG, Samsung, and Roku smart TVs across the planet. Now, I've been doing a welcome to country each and every week, and this week is no different. It's a special acknowledgement of the part that our traditional and indigenous communities play in the development of our cultural identity. So I want to respectfully acknowledge the people of the Yugambeh language region, that is the Gold Coast, Queensland, Australia, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet, and pay my respect to the elders past and present and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people listening here today. Now, I just want to say before I introduce you to the lovely Brett James Bishop that this morning I had the privilege of doing my first international virtual press conference announcing the collaboration between Everyday Women's Network, streaming TV, the Tony TV channel, and Zondra TV Networks USA. What a privilege it was to be in the presence of such amazing women. And please look forward to this space as Zondra and I continue to expand the bounds on which you think about traditional TV, linear TV, and its replacement, streaming TV, which provides platforms for you to speak your truth and share your message. And the reason I mention that today is because one of my passions is in life is giving voice to people who are courageous enough to talk about their story, and my wonderful guest today is no different. Before I start the show though, just a short warning that topics and discussion within this show today may trigger people listening. And it's important for you to remember that there is help available for anything that this triggers in you today. We will be talking along adult themes and having adult discussions. And whilst predominantly we are a business show, we are in the business of life. And in life, things happen. So I want to introduce you to a very special young man, Brett James Bishop. And he's a filmmaker, director, writer. He is a son, a brother, and an amazing friend. And he and I have been online friends for quite some time now. And we started a conversation back in 2019 around the documentary Neverland, talking about Michael Jackson. And the Neverland documentary had just been released, and I'd been very vocal in commenting around my thoughts alluding to Michael and the documentary. And that's how Brett and I started our conversation. And back then, I wanted to talk to Brett, talked about his experience and how triggering Neverland in particular was for him. And I made him a promise back then that if ever he wanted to talk about his story, then I would give him space and time to do so. And I want to remind the audience and want you to be very cognizant of the courage it takes a young man to step up and talk publicly about the trauma of life. And so I want you to keep that forefront in your mind as I introduce you today to the wonderful Brett. Good morning, Brett. Good evening in the US. Thank you for joining us today.
Yes, it is. It is definitely evening, but good morning or good afternoon to you.
it's morning, afternoon, evening somewhere across the planet, isn't it?
Always. So Brett, yes.
We started a conversation as friends quite a while ago, and I was looking back over our conversations yesterday when I was preparing for the show and wanting to remind people that it's really, really important that we continue to have these conversations. So I want to start at the beginning, and with your permission, I'd like to talk a little bit about growing up. Are you okay with that?
Yeah. Ask away. Ask questions. I'm here to answer.
I'm here okay. to show you. So let's talk about what it was like growing up for you.
I am in Utah, in the United States. Yes. Utah is known to be very dominantly LDS. It's the Latter-day Saints, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I was raised in the church, but the household I was raised in was pretty abusive.
Yes.
And I didn't know why when I was a kid. I didn't know through childhood that this was abuse. I didn't know that this was trauma until high school, and then starting to piece things through. But growing up was, you're presented the world that's given to you. You exist in that reality that your parents create for you, or maybe even lack thereof sometimes. But it was all right. Until I realized what wasn't all right later on.
And that's the thing. When we're children, we only know the family and the environment to which we were born. And it's often not until we grow and start to experience life as an adult that you start to question exactly what it means to you and the way you grew up. So I want to talk briefly, Brett, and for you to explain to the audience some of the fundamentals around the Mormon religion, if you're okay with that.
I don't know if I'd be the best person to talk. I guess I could try. The fundamentals is just where the church came from. Joseph Smith was a prophet, and he was visited by Heavenly Father and Jesus Christ, the Holy Ghost, and was asked to create this true church that had been left off the planet for a very long time. And through there, this dynasty has been created, since the 1860s. And yeah, now it's just the dominant religion. It's very much in control of a lot of things here that some it shouldn't be. But yeah, so culturally though, that's really where you can almost remove it from what the church is and what the church teaches to how the members have taken it and how they have kind of cultified it in a way. I don't even know if cultify is a word that is now.
Cultify is actually a great word.
Is it? Okay.
I think it's a good word to use because good. In cults, there is life only as the cult sees it. And once you step out of sight of that, you become estranged from the cult principles and practices. And Brett, growing up, did that mean for you that you didn't know much outside of the Mormon Church teachings until you got older?
Definitely. 100%. Yeah. 100%. It was all, it's all about the culture. And again, there is a separation from what the church is to what the culture is. And if you go anywhere outside of Utah and you go to, and you're part of the, I'm just going to say LDS, if that's okay. The LDS faith, anywhere else, it's a completely different community. So it's mainly, I think the stigmas are really big in Utah more than anywhere else. So.
And Brett, is there any, I'm trying to get an understanding of why this seems to center on poor old Utah. Is it just because that's the home base for the Mormon religion?
Yeah. So, Joseph Smith is from the East Coast, and they were kind of persecuted once the church started gaining members at that time, and they were forced to leave, or if it was Brigham Young, I apologize. I know there's going to be a bunch of Mormon specialists on me with this. I apologize. The point being is that at one point the church was over East Coast, and they traveled, and once they got to Utah, that's where there's a famous saying where I believe it was Brigham Young said, this is the place, and that's where they established themselves and have ever since. So
Utah seems to be the epicenter for the religion. And help me understand some of the things that you experienced as being born into the Mormon religion.
Things I experienced basically were social, what were social norms, you could say. Within that, I remember like the first time I met, I had a friend, I think it was in fifth grade, that was Catholic. And that was like a big deal because everyone else, as far as I knew, and as far as I associated with, was LDS. So it was just kind of being in a bubble, and of at certain ages, you go through certain steps in the church and you gain certain, you know, you advancements, I'll say, because I don't really want to speak for the church per se, but it's, you know, there's that, but again, it's the culture that is, you know, you must be baptized at 8 years old. There's no question that you wouldn't choose. They say you choose it, but you're also 8 years old, that you wouldn't choose to be baptized. And then you become an official member of the church and whatnot. And so, those are the type of things growing up, as far as what was expected, I think is probably the best way of putting it.
Yeah. Brett, if I may, you talked about growing up in an abusive home. Can you explain to me what that meant for you in particular?
To explain that, because I think this will be an ongoing theme today, to explain that, you have to go into the cycle. And where did the cycle start? So it didn't start with me or what happened to me. It started with my mother. And she was the oldest of all her siblings. She was verbally, physically, spiritually abused since the get-go. Her father was a raging alcoholic and abused her mother in front of her, to the point where even her mother would yell out for my mom as a young girl to try to help. So that type of trauma and stigma, like, and again, we're talking decades ago. Now we're barely getting to the point where we could have this conversation. So imagine going back 50 years and dealing with that, maybe even longer, and growing up. So she was, and it's kind of a long-winded answer, I apologize, but she is again the oldest of her siblings. So she in a way raised the siblings, because the mother had her own situation going on. But this was something where it was very hush-hush. Again, culture now is tough in Utah if you're kind of outside of the LDS culture, not to use the word again, but back then it was quiet. They call them wards, so that you gather together and you have your own wards of group of people depending on where you live, and then those wards make up stakes. And anyway, so when you're in your ward, you put on, back then mainly, you put on your happy face and nobody knows what's going on. And I mean, that's kind of probably how it was back at that point in America, regardless, maybe elsewhere as well.
Yeah.
So she never got to talk or understand exactly what she was going through. And she went straight from living with parents, if you want to say parents,
yes,
to being married. And when you get married, especially back in that time, you were to be married very early and you were to have kids immediately and you were to have a lot of kids. And I'm sure that's very cultural versus, I don't remember reading in the Book of Mormon that you're supposed to have, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 kids. So yeah. I think that's mainly culture, but it was, so for her, she went from raising her own siblings and then being expected to have her own kids. Now she had 7 of her own. I'm 6. So I'm in the lower half. But yeah. So with her, I think that cycle of abuse happened because I don't know how she, I don't think she abused her siblings the way that she abused her own children. And I think that I don't think she will ever understand that she was the abuser. I think she is so gone with trauma and so absolutely broken that there's no way she would, therapy would never be an option. And all of that, you know, that's available now that we can talk again as we are right now. So with what happened with me, I have to go back to the cycle of that. And I'm sure with her father, I'm sure there is all sorts of stuff, him growing up. So, you know, that's what happens with that, like, you know, as it does with any abuse.
I was just going to say, apologize. No, please don't apologize. It's important
I'll tell you why.
These conversations, because for many people, they don't understand that what they're doing is abuse until you step outside and recognize, oh my goodness, I was abused. And therefore, unless I heal my own abuse, it's going to be perpetuated in my life going forward. And so I know that you have done that and started on your healing journey. And it's been incredibly difficult for you, Brett. I know that. And in sharing part of my own history around trauma is that you're responsible for your own healing, but you're not responsible for the healing of your parents, your siblings, or anyone else. You can only do your own stuff. And it's incredibly hard to remove yourself from that cycle, isn't it?
Right. Absolutely. The reason why I was saying sorry is I'm bobbing around a lot. I actually just cut my leg open. So I'm sitting here trying to like be very like, I'm not,
oh
you know,
my God.
But
you
it's not bad. No, it's not bad. I really scraped it. We're good. By the way, we got to get this out. I am also a super sarcastic and funny guy. So if I, at any point, because again, I know that there are those watching and we talked about trigger warnings. If there's at any time where if I laugh at something with abuse, you're going to see that it's really a defense mechanism.
I was just going to remind people.
Okay, good.
I was just going to remind. So, Brett, just
I try not to, though.
No. But this is a really important concept for the audience to grasp, because recently we have a very prominent female in the public eye. And her trauma is pretty recent. When I say recent, within the last 10 years. And she was hounded by traditional media when she gave the Prime Minister the side eye. And there was a whole range of conversation about the inappropriateness of her behavior. I'm telling you from my perspective and from many experts' perspective, that side eye she gave the Prime Minister had zero to do with disrespect and everything to do with her trauma. Wow. So from her trauma perspective, here's a white male big guy in her space. And the similarities between a white man in power and the similarities to her perpetrator were evident to me and anyone else who works in trauma. And that's something we have to talk about, Brett, that people who have suffered trauma may not react in the way that people think that they should or that is acceptable in the community. And that should be okay. people need to understand that people in trauma, recovering from trauma, healing from trauma, will have defense mechanisms that they have no control over, that they may down the track be able to mend and mold to suit certain social norms, but we should not expect that from them in the first instance. And you're very vulnerably saying, this is what happens for me. The only way I can cope with this level of trauma is that I'm sarcastic and I laugh inappropriately. And I think that as society, we need to accept this in trauma. And it's about trauma-informed care. And we need to be having the discussion more often. Yeah. Don't you agree?
I do. And I think the sarcasm started with not being able to approach the subject. And and not being able to even within myself, you know, approach the subject. I have, and I'm sure we'll get to this, so I'm kind of jumping to the end here, you know, but through my own meditation, my own coping skills, learning coping skills, and going through Alcoholics Anonymous, I have learned to settle that down and kind of, you know, put a little lid on it. But so I'm much better with all of that because I've been able to go through it. Like that. But I mean, there's even siblings I have now that can't even bring up or just flat out deny, you know, what we went through. And I think the bottom half of the kids kind of got it worse than the top. So I don't know. I wasn't around for all of them, but that's kind of seems from story time of and sharing what they're willing to share. It seems like we kind of got it. I didn't get as bad as my older brother. Like my older brother right above me, he got it bad. I was kind of, I learned how to fly under the radar probably because of that.
Yeah.
But
so Brett, tell me about the moment that you sort of were conscious that what you'd suffered was abuse. Can you walk me through that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was high school. So I went, it's a long story long, but middle school, I didn't go to the middle school that in the town I lived in. I went with my dad, who was a school teacher, but there was a canyon in between my middle school and my backyard. So I didn't really have a lot of friends and I just kind of stuck to myself. But once we moved and I actually went into high school where I was living, that's when I was able to start getting friends. So I was no longer living in that little bubble per se. And then when you're in elementary school, I couldn't for me.
You only know I didn't what know. You know.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that was traumatic. And I mean, we can if you want to talk about what even happened in childhood that was abuse, I'll let you know.
I am happy for you to talk about that if you're comfortable, Brett.
Oh, yeah.
And just for the audience, again, I'm issuing you a trigger warning, but it's important that we have these conversations so people can recognize behavior for what it is. So I'm going to hand over to you, Brett, and in your own words.
Let me rant. I'm just kidding. See, absolutely. That's the sarcasm. That's the moment. No. So to finish the thought with high school, so I was able to get friends. And when they would see, first of all, how very closed off my house was, nobody was really allowed inside the house. And for them to kind of see behavior, and I started getting feedback from them that, hey, this isn't normal. You know, it kind of felt like a Full House episode. I'm sure you all know Full House, you know, where all of a sudden the kid from the outside comes into their perfect world and he's being abused and they're like, wait, this isn't right. So I was that kid coming into their world and they're kind of like, what? You know, what happens? And I mean, I even had a moment with a sibling that beat up another sibling. But I mean, it wasn't like, you know, brothers fighting. It was my brother who was out of school for 2 weeks and I had to lie about why he was out of high school, why he was not attending school. So and that comes with threatening. But I mean, so we can even move backwards. My mom did a lot of things where she expected a lot from my dad. My dad was a Marine, then Army Reserve, was a mechanic and a school teacher at the same time. So he wasn't around too much, which that was kind of the staple, I want to say, culturally, or expected that the dad works and the mom stays home and raises the kids and does the cooking and all that. You know, we're going back to this, you know, the Cleavers type, you know, Leave It to Beaver type idea, but in a more realistic, deranged type of way. And so, you know, my dad and I never really had a dad in the traditional sense. I mean, I had a dad, and he was there, it was fine, but it wasn't ever a bonding, you know, type thing ever. And so anyway, so she would expect a lot from him, put a lot on his plate, put a lot of expectation and pressure. And when he didn't deliver, it was all out hell. And that happened a lot. And there was times where we would wake up when we were first grade, second grade, third grade, young kids, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. And my mom would be on the floor crying, saying that my dad did something, or if you come home and the furniture's gone, because your dad couldn't pay the bills, if you come home and your bed is gone. And you know, when you are a second grader, your home
that's hard
thing. And so it is. Yeah, that, I mean, it's so I'm going to school and I'm not doing well because I'm thinking, am I going to have a house to come back to? And it was really all of just playing. It's almost like they were divorced without being divorced and kind of using the kids' obsession.
Yes.
It was a lot of that. But my mom was also very, again, for whatever reasons, you know, I don't want to justify it, but for the reasons that happened was she would abuse in a way of physical. She had a yardstick that she would.
Yes.
Rail on us. There's a shoe that's next to her that she can throw unopened cola cans. I mean,
ouch.
And it's to the face. It's not to anywhere. And I actually realized that even as we got older into high school, the violence got worse because it became less close combat because we were bigger, and it became more of what can we throw you. And I remember I took that yardstick and I broke that into as many pieces as I can one day. I buried it in my backyard. I remember that. That was cathartic, I suppose. But there it is. And so with, again, high school, having those friends, and you start realizing, oh, this isn't right. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, the reason why I stayed outside so much when I was a little kid wasn't because I had a great imagination, which I do, and I was playing outside and stuff, but it was really a way of just staying away and staying under the radar and not being part of things. And it's, I mean, that's continued on. And so that's where the complex PTSD comes in. And
we can
go into that too, because that complex PTSD is
rough.
I wasn't diagnosed with that until even after we've been talking. That came up later. So anyway, I don't know if I'm jumping here. So
no, that's fine. I wanted to have an organic conversation about trauma in general. So in talking about PTSD, mm-hmm. I guess the simplest way is that you have experienced trauma, and from a young age, that has created pathways in your brain that trigger you to react when you're in certain situations. And it's fear-based because your body is trying to protect you from what you perceive as fear, because what you experienced as a child was fearful and scary. And so going forward into your adult life, it keeps happening. Even though you've moved out of the family home, you're living an independent life, it still happens. Your brain keeps trying to protect you, and you have to learn how to deal with that, don't you, Brett?
Right. Well, yeah, there's a lot with that.
Yes, a lot with that, so. There is a lot with that.
I mean, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in talking about trauma, people have to understand that decades of trauma takes double decades to heal and move out of. So one of the important conversations that we should be having in society is when we know and find children from suffering from trauma, our first point of call should be counseling and therapy, because statistically, if we don't help immediately, then you and I are dealing with these things as adults, and in adulthood it takes decades to navigate through, as you know, Brett.
Absolutely. And the thing about that is if the cycle continues, so with my mother's dad, I'm getting confused.
Yes.
And then her, and she carried on the same cycle.
Correct.
There are, I can't speak for my other siblings, because I don't know how they parent. I know that my brother older than me that had it really bad, that got it really bad, made a point. And I remember we had conversations as we were kids saying, we will never raise our kids this way. So we actually did recognize to a very small extent that there wasn't something exactly right. And he's done an amazing job with his children. Aww. He has absolutely switched it. The thing with me is I didn't realize this until recently. I continued the cycle of abuse, but it wasn't outward.
It was inward. That's the next thing that we need to talk about. Yeah. Wherever alcoholism, drug abuse, promiscuity, antisocial behavior exist, unless there's a diagnosed psychological reason for that, it usually goes back to trauma. In Absolutely. Most instances, if you go back far enough, there will be trauma driving drug abuse, alcoholism, sexual abuse, childhood abuse. It's not inherent in human nature for these things to happen. They happen for a reason, and as Brett is demonstrating, sometimes this is intergenerational, multi-generational, and it takes courage and acceptance to move yourself out of these cycles and to start to heal. It takes courage to heal. It takes courage to talk about it. It takes courage to have conversations about what this looks like for me. It takes courage and vulnerability to talk about what it's like living in that depths of blackness and despair because of trauma.
Right. And to add to that, I'm multi-layers here. So for me, of course, I beat myself up all the time. I don't believe myself. And I was actually going to send you a little meme that I saw earlier, but I was like, I don't want to harass her. So I'll just tell her later.
Harass me, Brett. Never. And yes, that's the thing. And that's the thing too. Inherent in all trauma is that lack of self-belief.
Right.
And I know for me, it's taken 50 years to have some level of self-belief, and all it takes is a mistake on an email, tech messing up, and I go back to that place of I'm not good enough. Who the hell do I think I am? Who the hell do I think I'm? Why am I trying? You know, I know those stories in my head. I know what it comes back at me, and it's a constant no, you're okay, you're safe, you're supported, life is okay now. This is just a glitch. Nothing more than a glitch.
Yeah. And well, that's perfectly said, because what the beam was saying, I'm going to just paraphrase it, was something along the lines of like, when you're feeling that you're struggling, when you're feeling like you're at your lowest, somebody else is admiring how strong you are. And
absolutely.
So it's like it goes both ways. And so like you're feeling like that, but I look at you like you're amazing. You've done, look at what you've done. Look at all the accomplishments, and then vice versa. You know, you.
Yeah, and I'm. Saying, I think I'm amazing. Equally.
I don't know. Sure.
See, and from my perspective, I think that if all you ever do is get yourself out of that trauma cycle, that's enough. Like, because that's a big deal. Yeah. That's a really big deal.
And I think there's getting out of the cycle. And then they're staying out of the cycle. So I know that sounds like two different things, but it's you're working on it every day. And it's unfortunately, that's your life. And it sucks. But the thing I kind of want to bring up and kind of put a spotlight on is, I don't know if that was, this is just something I got in me that I wanted to, that told me to kind of bring it up. I'm wondering if there are listeners that had never considered that the cycle of abuse can continue with them, but within themselves. I think with us, we've worked through that. But at one point, that would have been mind-blowing for me to be like, oh, that's why I do that.
That's why I drink so much.
Or even if you don't drink, say you stay away from drugs and all everything like that,
There'll be something.
That's why I can't connect.
Workaholic.
Or I can't connect emotionally with someone that I'm dating. Or why they don't date, and I mean, a flurry of things. So it's, you know, once you can step back and draw that line back to where it started, or you know, those things, you know, that's where. So I really want to put a spotlight on that, because that again would have been 15 years ago, 10 years ago would have been mind blowing.
I agree. Things that I talk about in and around trauma now, had I known back then, they would have been life-changing. So it's why I feel so passionately about making sure people understand about the trauma cycle and inheritance. It comes through your DNA. The trauma sits in your DNA. So you have to, first is awareness, next is counseling and healing, and then third is to keep continuing your life and what that looks like and doing what you're passionate about. Now, before I get on to what you do now, I just wanted to quickly touch on what it was like discovering that in amongst all of this trauma that you discovered that you were gay. How did that play out for you? Because, again, that's just another element of the way society treats us, and it should be just a normal part of life. Oh, I'm heterosexual. Oh, I'm gay. Oh, I'm bisexual. It's okay.
Whatever it is,
you know, you love who you love.
Right. It was kind of second nature. It was always there. And I remember my family was super racist and also very big with anything. And so,
yeah.
You know, it was just across the board. It was such a good time. And again, yes. sarcasm.
But yes.
It was very traumatic, but, I didn't really ever second guess it. I learned how to fly under the radar and not really, you know, if I wasn't on that radar, then I was fine. Now, don't get me wrong. I was on it a lot. I did a lot of, I was a hyper kid. I was all over the place and getting into trouble all the time, but I learned how to kind of balance that. But with that being said, I just remember watching, I don't know if you guys have Saved by the Bell out where you're at. Or,
yes.
You know,
yes.
So
I know Saved by the Bell.
Yeah, yeah. So I was always like, I want to be like Kelly. Not that I want to be female, but it's like, I want to have a guy like Zach when I'm in high school.
Yes. That's,
and that was just it. It wasn't anything.
Yes.
I remember I never paid attention to gender and I never paid attention to its sexuality. So as much as I played Superman, which was primary, I would play Wonder Woman just as much. And it was more about storytelling, to be real with you.
Yes.
It's more about me sculpting, you know, different episodes. And that's something my parents always made fun of me for. Not in a bad way, but just, you know, poked fun.
Yeah.
Because I was like, most kids are out in playgrounds and they kind of just do, you know, it's a bank robbery, whatever. I would go out and I would play, you know, an episode. I would have a first act, second act conflict, and then a resolution. I'd have commercial breaks. I would, you know, and I just mimicked what I saw as a kid. You know,
amazing.
So is that from 3, 4, or 5 years old? It was insane. But I would love to talk about our initial thing that brought us together, which was the Leaving Neverland documentary.
Yes,
because I don't know if we were going to do that, but.
You know, that's fine, because I had such a powerful reaction to that, and I know that you did too, and that's actually what started our conversation. So, yeah, over to you, Brett.
Oh, okay. First of all, I was the biggest, I want to say biggest, I was a huge Michael Jackson fan. Michael Jackson fan. I had the posters and all of the, I had DVDs and like music videos that are kind of like rare as far as I could tell. But I mean, I had everything. It didn't matter how many copies were released. I had all the copies and whatnot. I remember when he died, I remember exactly where I was. I remember like the feeling of loss, because I was kind of closeted, because Michael Jackson wasn't very super popular, at least in the United States, when he died, especially the decade before. So if you were a Michael Jackson fan, unless you had like, you know, a really good self-esteem and thick skin, you were kind of a closeted Michael Jackson fan. So I would listen to his music when horrible things happen. If I went, you know, I had a friend die or, you know, whatever it was, I'd always go back to his music. And then I did it in the beginning of June of 2009. I had a really close friend of mine pass away from suicide. Yeah. And I was listening to Michael Jackson straight through. And then 3 weeks later, Michael Jackson died. And then it's almost like, what do I do now? So that's just, I really have to make sure I really put a point on that. So then when Leaving Neverland was coming out, it was coming to Sundance, which is here in Utah. I go to Sundance in Park City every year. But when I heard, you know, Wade Robson was one of the guys, I was like, dude, this guy used to dance with him. Like, this guy's a liar. Like, there's no way that this is real. And I did boycott Sundance because I thought it was ridiculously out of date, because I was just, you know, the Michael Jackson fan that's going to defend no matter what. And then I think it was the beginning of March or something, it was on HBO for that year, 2019. And I said, okay, I'm going to go into it, because I even had court documents that were public that I just had to print it out in a binder. So I would know my stuff. Like, I can go toe-to-toe with somebody with it. And as I watched this documentary, the more it fell in line with so many things that weren't even being discussed, but timelines and how they brought the receipts. I mean, that's that phrase. They had the receipts, they brought it. And even if there's a few little tiny moments that may seem like memory or whatever, there was way too much
for it
not to have happened. And so I remember I turned off, I think I went through, because it's 4 hours. I believe I went through three. Yeah, and I was
sick. I remember us talking about that, Brett, that you couldn't watch it all the way through because how triggered you were.
But I did. And I did it all one night. But I had to take like an hour break. And then after that, I didn't talk to anybody for 3 days. And I know that sounds incredibly dramatic, but here's the thing from my childhood. I felt safe in Michael Jackson. And I didn't realize this until later.
And that safety's just been taken away from you.
Yep. He was all about children. He was all about, as far as like, I'm here for you, heal the world. You know, that's what I grew up with in an abusive household. So there's a lot of reasons why that shouldn't, once you know that, you know, my reaction doesn't seem too dramatic. It seems pretty.
No, pretty as expected.
Yeah. But the thing with James, and this is the main thing I was talking to you about, James Safechuck is the other guy. And this is what really got me, is that it actually made me remember a sexual assault I had when I was 5 or 6. And this is really what we initially were talking about. Yeah. And I didn't realize that it was sexual assault. How old am I? I was like 37. 37 or 38, or no, 36, 37, doesn't matter. You know, really late into my 30s. Finally realizing that 30 years prior, that this was actually a sexual abuse thing because of the way it happened. And I can go into that story, but it's, you know, I was never, it was a sexual assault by my friend's dad. And my friend, okay, this was a trigger warning. I know you did it, but this is.
Yes, we'll keep doing it. That's fine.
And I'll still kind of paint around a bit. I'll give you enough. My friend and I were playing, we're around the same age and we're young, 5 or 6. And then he started wanting to play a sexually charged, you know, kind of not role play, but kind of a thing that we did back and forth and had to do playing with areas and things like that. And I, you know, I'm a little kid. I didn't really think you don't know. Yeah. And so I was like, okay. I'm like, I don't know how it brought, obviously I'm not gonna be able to tell you how it was brought up, but I remember that somehow he told me that his dad would play it with him. And that's whatever. And then he started to explain how his father looks in, you know, that private area versus how we look. And he was things like, there's hair, you know, and things like that. And that was actually my introduction to that. Yes. And I was like, that's interesting, because I'm a kid. I'm like, that's weird. I wonder what that looks like. And I guess, you know, that he told his dad at some point, and we were playing sometime later, weeks, I don't know, months, maybe, I don't know. And his dad came home and he goes, hey, I heard that you were interested in this. And so he revealed himself to me and actually had me touch him. And that's the extent it went. Not that that's not horrible by itself already. Yeah. So there was never anything beyond that. But he made sure I knew, hey, you were interested. You asked me to see it. This is all on you. I would have never done this if you didn't ask for it. And so,
but you were a 6-year-old.
I was just a kid.
No, you were a kid.
I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to say anything. I don't want any trouble. My little brain's not going to go super deep into that. It's just, I'm not getting in trouble. But it seemed to just not have, I don't want to say it didn't bother me, because it really did when you look back on how things progressed. Yes. But once the Leaving Neverland, it was something with James Safechuck. I'm trying to remember what it was, but I can't remember. But there was something how he said it.
Yeah.
I think it was about the rings that Michael gave him. And about the And when I saw, first of all, I wanted to be James's best friend at that point. I still hope to meet him someday or get in contact with him someday. But then it was very much of like, oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, that was that. That's what, because he was a good guy. He was a nice guy. I don't want to hurt him and get him in trouble. And that's really what it was. Even now I'm feeling it like that anxiety of, I don't want to get him in trouble.
You know, exactly.
Not to quote the thing.
But. No, but that's part of the reason why these crimes happen, is because little people don't want to get big people in trouble. And we forget that the adult is the power in the situation, not the child. It's got nothing to do. They have no power. They have no ability to get themselves out of that situation. Right. It's the wrongdoing of the adults. And the adult in turn may have had that happen to them as a child, but it still doesn't make it right.
Right.
And as you said, Brett, oftentimes for many, 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 many people, they don't realize the trauma until decades later. Yeah. You know, people have written to me about being 75 and realizing because they've read a book or watched something and they've been triggered and thought, oh my goodness, that's what happened.
Yeah.
And it's, it's because they've popped it down so deep and buried it so deep, and it impacts on their lives in ways that they don't know until they start that journey of healing and discovery.
Right.
And to live your life and the thing is, Brett, that lack of healing in trauma robs you of your best life. Do you know what I mean? So absolutely. From my perspective, little Brett could have been a global filmmaker of note.
Yes.
And the trauma robs that potential. And that's not to say that it can't happen, because I actually believe that it can still happen. And you are producing great content and movies now. And there's nothing to say that you won't continue to do that and build on that for the rest of your life. But the potential that you had as a 6-year-old is robbed from you because of trauma, which is why it's so important to recognize what can happen and what it robs a child of unless they get help and assistance, counseling and therapy.
Right.
There's no other way around it, is there, Brett?
No. And I think just having the education, kind of as what you're saying, having the education of what that is and what child and sexual abuse is. So
yes.
I'm going to assume I didn't recognize it as abuse because it wasn't it wasn't these graphic, horrible, like the main
correct.
Horrible, you know, type things. And so
but I kind of like, still whatever. Abuse, but absolutely. It's still abuse.
Yeah.
It's still abuse.
And even when I thought about it, when after watching the documentary, even as I still was processing it, the first person I told, I can't remember such a blur, but I was just like, you know, this is what happened with me, but I don't feel like that's not molestation, because I asked for it. And he cut me off. Is my friend Blake, actually. He's a psychologist now. And he cut me off and he said,
yeah,
you were a child in the situation. End of story. There's no other.
That's it. End of story. And it's not just children. It's women. If there's someone in a position of power, be they male or female, they are the power holders. They are the ones that either perpetrate a crime or they have a decision to make around whether they abuse someone. And it's about power. And so the person in power has the control. So the other person doesn't. So it's never, ever, ever your fault. I don't care what anyone says. No one asks to be abused or raped, assaulted. No one. And if you are abused, raped or assaulted, it's not your fault. It doesn't matter what you say. It doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you wear. It doesn't matter where you're at. It doesn't matter about your age. You are the victim. The other person has the power. They are the perpetrator. They are at fault. And as a society, we need to stop blaming victims. Because victims bash themselves up enough. Because I know what goes through your brain. Why was I there? Why did I ask that question? If I hadn't done this, this wouldn't have happened. If I hadn't have said that, da-da-da-da-da-da. We bash ourselves up enough without society doing a pile-on as well. And I remember, particularly in the aftermath of the Michael Jackson documentaries, people saying, oh, but those kids, the parents shouldn't have let the kids be there. No, Michael is the adult in the situation. He has the control by virtue of celebrity and power and money and gaslighting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, we could have a whole show on what gaslighting looks like.
Let's do it.
And how it, we absolutely, I was just, I'm looking at the time going, I just haven't quite have enough time with,
oh,
with
no, not now.
Brett at the moment. No, no, we'll do it later. We'll do it another show.
Another time.
I'll get Brett back again, because people need to understand that these people in powerful positions that perpetrate these crimes, they just want to get away. They just want to get away with what they're doing. And they will lie. They will gaslight. They will cause you to believe that it's your fault. And what I'm saying is never, ever, ever blame a victim. Always believe a woman. Always believe a child. And yes, I can hear the naysayers going, oh, but they lie. Do you know the actual percentage of people that lie about crimes like that? 1%. So if you believe 100%, then 99% of the time you will be showing your love and support for that person, that person that's just disclosed. And I'm telling you that the first time someone discloses, if you don't believe them, you triple the impact of their trauma. So are you a listening audience? Someone discloses to you, you refuse to believe them, for whatever reason, you triple the cost to them mentally. And that's not okay. It's not okay. You can if you go from the perspective of always believing them, then down the track, you can change your mind. But if it isn't true in that 1% of cases, then you've actually damaged the whole process for everyone else. Does that make sense?
And I think, let me add to that, if that's okay, and see if you agree. Even if there's a moment or there's something in you where you don't necessarily believe them, or it's something that's kind of hard to believe,
I would say
take a step back and look at them and think to yourself, what do they need right now in this situation? Other than
absolutely,
I might not believe it, but what can I provide them that they need in this moment? Mm-hmm. And if it's something like attention, and I'm not in a negative way, but attention of just needing to get off their chest. If it's something where it's something violent has just happened, we need to get authorities involved, or how do we want to go about that?
Support them.
And support it, even if you don't necessarily believe it right off the bat.
Absolutely. I think that is just one of the keys that people need to remember, that in that instance, when someone discloses or tells you about something of this nature, you need to just listen to them, because whether it's true or not is actually irrelevant. Right. Part of their healing journey is that disclosure. That point in time starts their healing.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, it at least gives them someone. They're not one person anymore. They're two. They have somebody that's listening to them. So,
and the other powerful thing about that is that those stories, whilst they remain untold, hold power over you. The moment that you open yourself up and talk about that story, it ceases to hold power over you and your life. Starts the healing process. And I know this works, because not only have I seen Brett's journey, not only have I observed on the sideline Brett's journey, I've observed and seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of other people walk the same way. And I know that these concepts we're talking about are important. And I know that people, we need to treat trauma in a different way, Brett, because we need to have whole adults. I don't want any more little Bretts being robbed of their potential because we didn't manage their trauma correctly in the first instance. You know, because someone would have known that little 6-year-old Brett was suffering in some way. Someone would have picked it up. A mother, a friend, a school teacher, someone would have had a moment that caused them pause, that they would have said, oh gosh, something's not right in Brett's life. Someone. But they didn't act on it. Yeah?
Well, we
they
hit it
didn't
well.
Act on it.
With the cultural, how we talked about that earlier, of how you're supposed to be as a family. Yeah, we hit it well. If you knew my mom outside of the household, she was the nicest. And she is nice. And
She did
some great things for people, but I really wish she would have been a lot more back home for us, you know, and whatever. But anyway, that's that. Anyway,
Brett,
what am I doing?
I am so grateful that you are here that you do have the courage and vulnerability to talk about this. It lights my soul when young men have the courage to have these difficult conversations, because they make it better for all the young men across the planet, and the older men too, to have these discussions. And we need strong men. We need recovered men. We need healed men. If ever in humanity, now's the time for men to seek healing and tell their stories. Brett James Bishop, I am so privileged to have you on the show today. We are completely out of time. We are going to do this again and make sure that we have further conversations, because I believe it is so important. Wonderful audience. Please thank my guest, Brett James Bishop, today. We will be back again. Thank you for listening to the Everyday Business Show. I'm your host, Tony Lontis, and we will be back next week with another show. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Bye for now, everyone.
I'm going to do it to the best of my ability, because if I fail, that means I fail for my entire female nation, I call it.
Is that possible? That was the question.